This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to have you with us today. Let's begin in Washington, where today House Republicans are set to pass a massive tax bill that amounts to over $1.4 trillion in tax cuts over the next decade. House Speaker Paul Ryan and other Republicans have been working on this bill for years. In many ways, these massive tax cuts define what it means to be Republican.
Read my lips. No new taxes.
With a government serving the people, not the other way around.
Everybody does benefit when government takes less from the people.
You can't raise taxes.
It is outrageous to suggest that raising taxes is a good idea.
We must give overcharged taxpayers some of their own money back.
A massive tax cut.
We've got to get out of the game of Washington picking winners and losers in the tax code.
To deliver this giant win for the American people and begin middle-class miracle.
Tax cuts are Republican dogma, even in an era when the party's leader, President Donald Trump, seems to be scorching the rest of the GOP identity in a fire filled with tweets and insults and friendly gestures toward Russia. We're going to have more on what the Senate is doing with tax cuts and, surprise, another Obamacare repeal a little later in the hour. But listen to President Ronald Reagan here, 1981, and you get a sense from this icon of conservatism what low taxes mean to Republicans.
We will restore the freedom of all men and women to excel and to create. We will unleash the energy and genius of the American people, traits which have never failed us.
What you just heard there is a moment that Paul Ryan still talks about from a president he talks about all the time. So how did American politics come to hate taxes so very much? Do American voters hate taxes as much as their politicians do? Molly Mitchell-Moore is professor at Washington and Lee University and author of Tax and Spend, The Welfare State, Tax Politics, and the Limits of American Liberalism. Molly, thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Also with us, Vanessa Williamson, a fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of Read My Lips, Why Americans Are Proud to Pay Taxes. Vanessa, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Vanessa, do Americans actually like paying taxes?
Well, in my book, I talk about their pride in taxpaying. And so it's not the same thing to be proud and to be happy. But Americans talk about being taxpayers in a very specific way. They use it as a kind of shorthand for being an upstanding, contributing person. So, you know, even when I was at rallies for the Tea Party, a group that was very angry about what they thought government was doing, I'd regularly hear people say, as a taxpayer, I... And the end of that sentence was never about taxes. It was always about their right to be heard. So Americans see taxpaying as a really important part of their civic responsibilities, a kind of evidence for their deservingness to participate.
There's even this American shorthand, isn't there? Work hard, pay your taxes. I work hard, pay my taxes.
Exactly.
Well, Molly, Vanessa says Americans are proud to pay taxes even if they don't like writing the check or seeing the withholding. But people who do hate paying taxes, Molly, probably feel like they have a home in the Republican Party. Was it always so?
The Republican Party has never been a fan of the federal income tax. But when I started my research, what I was sort of interested in was this question about how and why taxes did move to the center of American politics in the late 1970s, early 1980s. And what I was surprised to find was that from the very beginning, both parties, Democrats and Republicans, had sort of pursued a low tax agenda, right? So even the so-called tax and spend liberals in the Democratic Party had been much happier to provide tax cuts rather than tax hikes.
I mean, is that as simple as the good politics of taking a hardworking family and saying, oh, you have $1,200 more now? That seems like pretty basic good politics.
It was good politics. And it was also good politics that worked for a specific moment in American history. So the Democratic Party is the dominant party after the Second World War. And after the Second World War, we have this extraordinary period of economic growth that produces extraordinary federal tax revenues. So the federal government is able to take in a lot of money at the same time as it's cutting taxes in this post-war period. And Democrats are able to sort of redistribute that to their constituents. But all of that comes to an end when that great economic boom comes to an end in the late 1960s. And that provides the Republican Party, which had basically been in the wilderness since the 1920s, to make a move, right, to become a majoritarian party again.
So, Molly, when you see this project now on Capitol Hill, a tax cut hovering around $1.5 trillion and all the unequivocal promises Republicans like Speaker Paul Ryan are making to get the bill done now. What do you see in this political moment?
In some ways, it seems to be a kind of zombie Reaganism, right? You mentioned in the intro that Paul Ryan is very fond of citing Ronald Reagan and citing the arguments that Reagan and the supply-siders that gathered around him in the early 1980s made about the ways in which the tax system was stifling American ingenuity, was stifling prosperity. And so that was the argument that in some ways made sense in the early 1980s, but it makes less sense now.
Vanessa, so sticking on Capitol Hill for a moment, I mean, the tax bill that's passing the House today polls miserably. Only 25% of voters in a poll that I saw this morning said they support the bill, and yet Republicans feel the need to press and press hard on this. How do you interpret those politics?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that struck me even more than the very low support overall is the fact that they only have 60% of Republican support when you ask about Republican support for the Republican tax plan. And in these highly partisan times, you'd really think they could get better numbers than that. So yeah, the level of support you're seeing for this bill is exceptionally low. And, you know, that really, to me, says something about the way they've approached this legislation. They have not done what Reagan did. They have not done what even George Bush did to pass tax cuts, which is to put up front very obvious benefits that will reach a lot of individuals. Instead, you know, there's real uncertainty about what's going to happen for most taxpayers, most individual taxpayers. The only thing that's clear is there's a big tax cut at the very top.
And do you have any sense from voters, from public opinion, from middle class people that they were clamoring for a tax cut when Republicans got elected? Is that what they were demanding from their Congress?
There is very, very little clamor for a tax cut these days. If you ask Americans in the last decade what bothers them most about taxes, about 10% of people say that it's the amount that they pay. About two-thirds say either that corporations are not paying their fair share or that the wealthy are not paying their fair share and should pay more. So this legislation really addresses the opposite of the primary concerns of most Americans.
You just said that people are concerned that corporations and wealthy people don't pay their fair share. This bill cuts taxes for both those groups in a gigantic way.
That's exactly right. So there's really no line that can be drawn between what public opinion says and what this legislation includes. Now, it's not always the case. I mean, it's not always the case that legislation is the result of what the median voter would want, but this seems exceptionally far from even the preferences of the Republican base.
Molly, I want to talk about Republicans a little bit more because this is a party that's in crisis. Members are retiring and leaving. President Trump is upending the Republican Party's identity. So how important is delivering a huge tax cut now to capital R Republicanism, even if, as Vanessa says, individual voters, even Republican voters, aren't really clamoring for a tax cut?
Well, I think that Vanessa is right, that there is no real demand among the Republican base, at least not the Republican base of voters, maybe the Republican base of donors, for this kind of a tax cut. And so honestly, the politics of this tax cut elude me. You hear a lot of Republican lawmakers saying that this is their last gap, this is their last chance to get a win in 2017. But I honestly don't understand the upside, right? Vanessa's right. If you look at historic Republican tax cuts, either the Reagan tax cuts of 1981 or the George W. Bush tax cuts of the early 2000s, those were tax cuts that skewed towards the rich, but they also gave really meaningful benefits to people in the middle and even the working classes. And so they were a much easier sell. They were more popular. This tax cut, as far as I can tell, doesn't have anything in it for those folks.
Well, the other side of a giant tax cut is a lot of debt. And Molly, there's been a lot of politics around debt in this country for a long, long time. Now, this bill is projected to increase the national debt by, as I said, $1.5 trillion. Now, when President Obama was in office, the Republican Party did an awful lot of hand-wringing over the size of the debt. Really, it was constant. They're not talking about it anymore. Is this just political opportunism?
I would say so. The Republican Party, at least recently, seems to be much more interested in debts and deficits when Democrats are in the White House and much less interested when Republicans are in the White House. And this is the case during the Reagan administration. It's the case during the George W. Bush administration, and it certainly seems to be the case now.
Vanessa, political opportunism over debt? I mean, one of the criticisms of modern conservatism that you hear a lot is that this long-term Republican project in cutting taxes is that if the debt goes up by a lot, it can put more pressure to cut entitlements later, Social Security, Medicare in particular. Eventually, the debt is so high, you get to a point where you say, sorry, we just can't afford it. We got to cut these programs. Do you buy it?
Well, I certainly buy that that's the rhetoric that you hear. And it's there's not great evidence that that kind of fiscal pressure actually ends up cutting entitlements. But it's certainly the political rhetoric that people who would like to cut entitlements use, right? So it eases the political argument, even if it doesn't ease actual cuts. But this year, I think that, you know, it's as Molly said, quite a remarkable year in that in the past, often we talk about tax cuts separate from benefit cuts. We act as if the money is kind of free, right? That there's never going to be a consequence. But this year, the Republicans are actually moving forward big tax cuts for corporations and some wealthy people alongside really quite obvious benefit cuts for everyone else. So that connection that's sometimes a little bit hard to make in sort of public discourse is actually a lot clearer this time than usual.
The history and the politics of a gigantic $1.5 trillion tax cut from Republicans in a populist moment in America. Molly Mitchell-Moore, professor at Washington and Lee University, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Vanessa Williamson with Brookings, thanks for powering through your cold. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.